Ghost. So I did what all young men do. I caroused and went sightseeing and touring in cities and so on.
I want to ask you something else about the French Canadians. You say you had a respect for them, a great respect.
Mm-hmm.
Other people I've talked to don't seem to share that respect in feeling towards French Canadians. Tell me
in
about
the military context?
Yes.
Or really?
Because not enough of them did join up, and quite often they weren't there with the full enthusiasm, because they didn't have the ties, one to Britain or to France.
Well, I've had some terrible arguments with a fellow who wrote this book. He's a bigot if there ever was one. He did Canadians in the Royal Air Force. And his son has a piano store downtown, Les Allison. He lives near Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
And he condemns the French in here, and he condemns all sorts. And he and I have sat here and argued about the French participation. But all I can say is that the squadron that I was associated with,
the Alouettes.
The Alouettes. They fought side by side with the other fellows. They bled and they blew up and they died and they escaped and they did all of the things that anyone else did.
Mm-hmm.
When they came back from raids, they were as enthusiastic about what they had achieved. However askance we may look on bombing today, that was the thing to do, and they came back jubilant about shooting down an aircraft or anything. And because they are a demonstrative group of people, they were probably more so than the snowy owl, the English, the Anglo-Saxon group. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I really cannot agree with the people who denigrate them,
mm-hmm.
But I don't know what the experiences were elsewhere, but I'm only talking about I can't remember how many men there were in the squadron, but a hell of a lot of them.
Yeah. Well, did they use French as an operational language?
If they had a crew of all French crew, they would.
Mm-hmm. But oftentimes the Alouettes were mixed.
And the Alouettes and the Snowy Owls are not mixed, but they had English people in their crew, so they, as they do today when you go to Quebec, they defer to us if we don't speak French,
mm-hmm.
because they have a greater capability than we do in the main of the two languages.
Yeah. Well, tell me a bit more about the operation. When did you actually join up with this, as an intelligence clerk with the two
squadrons? That would be June of 44.
That's an auspicious
that was,
month,
that was
isn't it?
Just when the squadron became got white paintings on the wings and D-Day and took place and all of that, and that was kind of exciting.
Did the operations change at all? Were you still striking at Germany, or were you...
Well, the targets changed, and there were more targets in France and the coastal cities, Cap Grenet and those places.
Do you remember any instances of cooperation with infantry, low-level bombing?
I know that one time the squadron bombed, they were to bomb ahead of the infantry, and I think both squadrons participated in this with other squadrons in 6th Group, and they bombed our own troops.
And this was in August of 1944.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And they came back, and I can recall seeing them in tears when they learned of it, and they were very, very distressed, to say the least. I mean, there was the slur on their professionalism and the anger at the... I guess at the generals or whoever had the senior officers who had planned the proximity bombing that close,
mm-hmm.
or the failure to send up signals to indicate that the troops had advanced faster than they had. And of course, once the target indicators are down, then they bomb on that, and
mm-hmm.
it's pretty hard not to.
Mm-hmm.
This, I guess it would be March of 1945. I had tried unsuccessfully to remuster the aircrew as an air gunner and was dissuaded and turned down or whatever you want to call it, turned down again. So I desperately wanted to go on a raid into Germany, so I inveigled my way with one of the crews, Flying Officer Evans.
Mm-hmm.
And on March the 22nd, just before the Allies crossed the Rhine, I went on a daylight raid. And I sewed up sergeant stripes in an air gunner's wing because I thought if I'm shot down, I'd like not to dig too many ditches, and I might as well be a sergeant because you're treated a little better.
Yeah. Did you call yourself Sergeant Bainbridge?
Well, I didn't call myself anything.
No, but what I'm saying is your papers would have said...
Well, you didn't carry papers with you, but the idiocy of it all is that we were taught to wear our dog tags, so I took my dog tags off, which said airmen, you see, and left them at home. So had I been shot down, I would have been completely unidentifiable. but you don't think about that at the time. So I knew people in the parachute section and the flying suit section, so I got all the money and the purse and Pandora's is what they were called. And from Pandora's box, when you opened it, you know, all sorts of things flew out, money and escape aids. And the crew were hand in hand, so they smuggled me onto the truck and stuck me aboard before the CO came around to wave them all goodbye, and I was already in the aircraft. So we went on a six-hour daylight raid into a place called Rhine, R-H-E-I-N-E, just across the Dutch border. And I thought it was all very exciting to see the flak coming up, and I was a little bit frightened, but I knew that I knew this crew had done 25 or whatever trips, and I felt very confident. And
was there any fighter?
We were escorted by Spitfires and the Mustangs, so, and keep in mind that the war was nearing an end by now, it's March 45, so there was just flak, that was all. Okay. And I watched the bombs go down and land on this marshalling yard, and I dropped the window out of the chute, and that dispersed, and played my little role, and came back. And
how long was the trip?
It was about 6 hours. And I saw one of the first rockets take off, one of the V-2 rockets from Holland. I guess the Germans were sending them up against London at the time, you know, the wavy contrail. Yeah. And,
was that an odd feeling?
Yes. That was the oddest feeling of all. I realized, even at that age and in that instant, that what we were flying in was obsolescent.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, already I knew they were obsolescent because the interrogations that we did of the crews, that were done of the crews, were revealing that the Germans were flying Messerschmitt 263s in these rocket-assisted aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And they went by in a flash so quick that the gunners couldn't get near them.
Couldn't.
And you realized that suddenly you were moving into another era.
Yeah.
And the rocket, I think, confirmed this. And, of course, one began to think about this when the buzz bombs and the rockets were landing. I went down to a fighter base one time in the south of England, the Spitfire base at Folkestone, to visit a friend of mine that I hadn't seen since we joined up. And watched the Spitfires take off and the buzz bombs were landing, and we were blown out of bed the next morning by a cross-channel shell. I still have a piece of the shrapnel, and I was scared pissless. And it landed beside my bed and shook us all up.
God.
Yeah. So I fished it out of the floor while it was still warm, and I said to Gil, "I'm sorry, Gil, but I'm going back to Yorkshire where it's safe." And I left that afternoon. I thought, to hell with this.
Yeah.
You know? That's the closest. That and the flak is the closest I ever came to any danger, so it was rather, you know, an ignominious kind of...
Well, did you get any flak inside the helmet?
No. The aircraft had a few little holes, I guess, but they were usual things.
Well, I imagine being sort of a supernumerary inside of this plane without any specific duties would have been worse than if you had a gun to hold on to.
I guess so. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the crew were understanding, and they said not to worry. I didn't know this, but apparently when the flak bursts, the greasy black smoke, then the danger is past. It's just preceding that. So when we came back, nothing was said.
Did the officers know that you were...
Oh, no. The crew kept it quiet for quite a while. And then somebody let the cat out of the bag, and my CO called me in, and he said, "I understand you went on a raid." And I said, "Yes." He says, "Do you know what would have happened?" And he said, you'd have been court-martialed. And I said, "By whom?" He says, "If you'd been shot down," he says, "you'd have come back to face a court-martial." And I said, "Well, that would be after the war, so it would be kind of irrelevant, wouldn't it?" he was a good guy. His name was Squadron Leader Lount, and he was a descendant of one of the Louts that was hanged during the rebellion of 1837, an interesting man.
Really?
He's dead now. He died a few years ago in North Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
But he laughed it off. He said, "Well, good for you. I'm glad you enjoyed it." And that was all there was to it.
Well, did you enjoy it?
Yes. I enjoyed it immensely. And I felt a closer bond with the people I had to work with. And
yeah, you'd actually been there.
It's what everyone should do if they work with other people, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I always carry that on into my business life later on. There was nothing I would ask other people to do if I hadn't done it myself or could do it myself. And occasionally, when you didn't have to, you'd roll up your sleeves and do it just to gain their respect and hold it.
Mm.
I think it's an axiom that's still worthwhile.
I think so too, actually.
Yeah.
I think we're becoming too specialized in a great many ways in our society.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so.
So I take it you were there until the end of the war, till V-Day.
When the war ended, or just before the war ended, most of the officers in our section were posted elsewhere. And one of them, Harry Warman, went to the south of England, and the phone rang one day, and he says, "Chuck, I need an intelligence clerk, and we're going to Germany in the army of occupation, and would you like to be it?" He says, "It'll only be one of you." And I said, "Well, fine, sure, when?" So he said, "Well, I'll talk to Lount, and we'll get you posted." So a couple of days later, I was down at Kenly, which had been a fighter base, but which had no phased out by this time because the war was ending. Just south of London. So they gave us a crash course in commando tactics and how to shoot and protect yourself and detect mines and kill somebody if you had to. And all this was crammed into 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And,
well, good God. And well, who was training you? Would it be
these
SAS?
No, they were army types. I don't know who they were at the time. Mm-hmm. But it was all very exciting because it was like giving a dog a piece of meat as opposed to kibble. You know, we had been living on a steady diet of discipline and routine for a year, and this came as a breath of fresh air to, well, I think, spirited guys 19 or going on 20. You know, it was something new and different. So we threw hand grenades and did all sorts of things on the off chance that the Germans would react to the occupation and perhaps counterattack us or do something like the Battle of the Bulge. So then we proceeded to Tilbury and got on an LST, or LCI, or one of those things that carries people. Mm-hmm. And we went across the channel and landed at a place called Bruges.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And then went into a little place in Blankenburg and were billeted in a hotel. And I can remember seeing mobs were shaving the heads of prostitutes, collaborators.
How did you feel about that?
I've always taken a rather calm view of prostitution. I've always felt that it's been around a long time, and what the hell that they.
Well, I was thinking more about the collaborators, how they treated the collaborators.
Oh, but these were prostitutes, as I understood it. But the collaborators were summarily shot. And
I was thinking more of the women who actually had German lovers, because mm-hmm. they had their hair
yeah.
shaved and tarred.
It bothered me a little bit, but it didn't bother me a lot.
It bothered you as a man reacting to a woman suffering?
I guess so, yeah. I
it.
Saw them crying and bent over in the street and huddled like this, and people would be holding them and shearing off their hair. And I saw them not so much as having had lovers. The word we were getting is that these were whores, and that they had made it with German soldiers, and they were had done dastardly deeds, and they were being paid back. And
mm-hmm.
as now coming back, I said at the time, well, what the hell, a whore, you know,
who
and I
cares
guess
what,
yeah, they don't care, so why should we?
Mm-hmm.
But the people thought differently, and I guess they had to vent their rage on something.
Mm-hmm.
And the Germans had been mm-hmm. defeated and fled, so. The people who may never have attacked a German if they had seen one, even with a weapon, probably derived some satisfaction from beating the shit out of some poor woman, I guess.
It's mob reaction, which
yeah.
is always disturbing.
Yeah, and it's frightening, yeah.
Yeah, you can't control it.
We weren't there very long, and then we boarded trucks and proceeded into Germany, and while we were in the Allied zone,
mm-hmm.
before entering Germany, people were still waving and hail the conquering hero, and of course we weren't conquering heroes, we were rainbow boys. We had come over after the storm, but we felt good to, you know, kind of swelled with all the bullshit and pride.
Well, being a Canadian, did they react to you differently than, say, Americans?
Well, I didn't know how they had reacted to Americans at the time, because it was the Canadians really that had conquered that part,
yeah.
and consequently, you know, we were the only game in town, I guess. So. But they treated us well, and they'd hand us bottles of wine and flowers. And
were the women friendly?
Girls would reach up and kiss us, but
yeah.
we didn't get much action. We didn't get any action there. We had a little loving in Blankenburg for the few days that we were there. And that was interesting. They probably were collaborators, too, who hadn't yet been caught. Anyway. Then
soldiers are soldiers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then we got into Germany, and of course we were told that we weren't to fraternize and not to smile or wave or any of those things. And I don't think we had to, because they didn't want to do it for us, so I don't know. You know, there was nothing to return. And then we got to Oldenburg.
Did you have any animosity towards the German people as a whole?
Interestingly enough, no.
Yeah.
I've always looked at civilians and with compassion and pity, and I looked at them and I thought, oh, you poor bastards, blown all to hell, and just as I felt about the Londoners and people that I'd seen there, and I thought, you know, you're caught in the squeeze play, and you probably never had much to do with this in the first place. And I didn't really realize at that time how many of them had fervently waved their flags and little banners for Hitler on the way up. But looking through history, I think we all do it to one degree or another. You have to only look at a political convention to see how mobs can be mesmerized by some eloquent leader.
I think we've just had a recent experience of that, haven't we?
That's right. That's what I was alluding to.
Conservatives.
Yeah.
The unfortunate thing there is that the wrong person got in.
Well, could be. I don't know.
Are you conservative?
Oh, yes, I'm a conservative. I was a Clark supporter.
I was a Crosby supporter, so we've covered all the bases.
Crosby, I thought, betrayed his feelings a little afterwards by some of his remarks.
He did, actually.
I thought he was lower. He lowered himself in my esteem a bit. But I'm prepared to go with
Maroney
and hope for the best. And I think that's about all one can do. You know, it's done.
So tell me, where were you finally stationed in Germany?
We occupied a school in Oldenburg, which is an old seat of the province of Oldenburg, in a lovely little town.
Mm-hmm.
And
were there Canadian troops in that vicinity? That occupation
yes, there was? Were. I can't remember the division, but they were still there as a sort of a guard to make sure that there. Our wing was a disarmament wing, and we had a large section of the country adjacent to the American zone to disarm.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, our role was to send out squadrons to four or five different sites, headquarters, and from there they would cover certain areas and they would retrieve rockets and do house searches to remove any weapons and recover aircraft that were intact and blow up bombs and search for mines and all of this sort of thing. And we had to record all that. And
did you meet any resistance at all?
No, not really. The Germans were very cooperative. We had a constant prey to them coming through our headquarters. Prince Hohenzollern was one, and he was interviewed, and various officers would be brought in and interrogated, and some civilians. And our role was to gather all the data we could on weapons, and I can remember one time our squadron sneaked into the Russian zone to grab a rocket at one of the V-2s.
So relations weren't good with the Russians?
It never was, no. Our padre was arrested when he went to Berlin and happened to drive into the Russian zone, and he was held incommunicado for 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've always been an obstreperous lot, you know. There's no question about it, you know. They're just different and distrusting.
Mm-hmm.
And so, anyway, that was the role of the squadron. So they captured all this, and then I was poring over files all day long with the help of a Czechoslovakian Canadian interpreter, and we would find search for graves of crews that had been shot down, and try and gather photographs and so on, and then turn it over to graves registration, and they would either exhume the bodies or arrange for burial. And
were you thinking at all of, say, Nuremberg that was coming up? Had you any orders to keep your eyes open?
Well, that was my next point. A lot of the material that we had was forwarded on to, I presume, headquarters intelligence. And we moved later to Celle, C-E-L-L-E. It's a beautiful ducal town near Hanover.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had rooms full of this stuff, and it was being sifted and sorted. And it was time-consuming work. And then that was sent off, I understand, as partial evidence to the Nuremberg trials.
Mm-hmm.
And then our stay finished there, I guess, April 46. And the unit was disbanded. And I was fortunate, and then I went to the Nuremberg trials.
Did you really?
For a week. No, 4 days, pardon me.
What trials did you see, the actual?
It was the trial of Ernst Kaltenbrunner.
He was head of the SD, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And that was why we picked that week, because two of my intelligence officers, my boss and this flight lieutenant, Harry Warman, that I told you about, who had called me, got me down, the three of us drove down to Nuremberg, and I don't know where they stayed, but I was billeted in with the Russians. And
tell me about that.
It was an interesting experience. Wonderful people, you know, the common soldier, but I was scared witless, because some of them were Mongols. They looked like Genghis Khan. They really were. They brought them in from, I guess, God knows where.
You would think that they would try and maintain the European balance, because they were almost rather sensitive to Europeans seeing Chinese soldiers or Mongolian soldiers.
Apparently not there. There were a few of us, Canadians, none from my squadron. I was the only LAC.
Mm-hmm.
But there were army types there and some Americans, and we were billeted there on a temporary basis in this thing while we were attending the trials of the role of the Russians. I never did get clear.
Mm-hmm.
Just digressing for a moment, while we were at Nuremberg, we went out one time to what they call the displaced persons camp, and it was Russians and in there,
mm-hmm.
displaced. And when they found we were Canadian, they apparently there was a play in process, and they hoisted us on their shoulders and carried us through this great hall, the three of us,
mm-hmm.
and we had pistols with us and so on. And they literally cleared the front row. There were ladies sitting there, and gentlemen, poorly dressed, but they were apparently higher rank than the ones at the back. They said something in Russian, and the things were vacated, and these people went to the back, and we were given the front seats.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched this unintelligible play. And it was interesting. I got the gist of it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a line from song that any Russian play can guarantee. It's an old Cole Porter song. But anyway, and they produced drink from somewhere, and we drank whatever fire water was going and toasted everybody, and away we went. But anyway, they were hospitable at Nuremberg, and then we went into the trial, and we sat in the visitors' gallery, and I still have the indictment, and I share it with a few friends once in a while who happen to be Jewish and want to see what happened to the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were at Nuremberg, we went out to Belsen, just not long after it had been liberated.
Mm-hmm. The smell probably still would have been.
And there were piles of kiddies' shoes and adult shoes and clothing and vestiges of hair and teeth and things like that. No,
no bodies.
Bits of bones in the and I took photographs of the ovens and all that and the gas chambers. I still have them. But the bodies had been cleared away and buried. And I went there with a friend of mine who Percy Spencer, who's now with Shoppers Drug in Toronto. He's Jewish. We've been friends for many years. And it was a very moving experience for him. And not just because he was Jewish, because there were others other than Jews who were killed there.
But it would be
But
more
it just
emotional.
Tore me apart. I just couldn't believe it, and the stench still hung over the whole thing. So I'll never forget that. And then when I went to Nuremberg, I then had a sense of justice being done. Now, one could philosophize about whether war crimes trials are right or wrong.
Personally think they're wrong, but
yeah.
I mean...
And in retrospect, I see the idiocy of the whole system in a way, but of them taking place. But anyway,
but
there were some...
What about the Kaltenbrunner trial, if you wouldn't mind, how it was held, your impressions of it?
Well,
he was a bloodthirsty man.
Oh, yes. And I felt quite justified at that time. And retrospectively, for some of them, I guess, you know, they deserved the death penalty, which most of them got.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose if one believes in common in British justice and so on, that Sir Hartley Shawcross, I think, was the Chief Justice then, they made good decisions based on a fair trial.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at it in that context, without getting into the philosophical things about war crime trial.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that Kaltenbrunner had done these deeds, and I had seen some evidence in my own little way of some of the things that had happened. I'd been to Belsen.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that the whole thing was wrong and that they were being brought to justice. So,
but you saw Belsen, and that would have increased your anger, or
yeah.
at least
oh,
brought
yes,
your anger
it
to...
It did.
But how could you blame Kaltenbrunner, who was head of, like, intelligence espionage?
Yeah.
For that particular...
Well, the evidence produced, as I recall, pointed that he had caused people to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, prisoners.
Well, hadn't he authorized the Ledici massacre? Because
I didn't recall that, but I am familiar with that incident where they raised the town. And
Poland.
Yeah, yeah, and that was one of many. So, I just felt on the little bit of evidence that I saw in those 4 days that...
He was
justice was being done to a criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched the others with interest that were sitting behind, Hess and Goering and all those. And
they were there at the same time?
Oh yeah, they all sat in the benches, and Kaltenbrunner stood, the defendant stood,
mm-hmm.
and answered the questions that were directed to him.
Well, digressing again, how did Hess look? Did he look coherent? Did he look like he was sane?
Oh yes.
Because a lot of controversies...
How can one tell from looking at someone whether they're sane? The most sane-looking people are raving schizophrenics. But,
sure.
But, you know, I didn't... At that time, I wasn't assessing them on their sanity. I just looked at them as...
I guess it was like television almost, watching these people you read about it.
And there was a program from the Americans and so on like that, showing, you know, who's on first. And,
who's on?
Yeah. What I have it here if you want to look at it.
I'd like to after.
Sure, for sure.
Was Goering still there?
No. Goering?
Did he commit suicide?
I think he had committed suicide by then, yes.
It's a shame because
just
they say
a couple of days before we got there, yeah.
Because they say he stole the show. He lost weight. He kicked his drug habits. And he was very articulate during the trials.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know if... you know, who slipped in the capsule, but anyway.
Yeah. Mm. That fascinates me, that particular trial. I guess we should move on.
Well, I have a book which a German friend of mine, whom I hired after the war by the name of Klaus Hofschild, who had been in the Hitler Youth, sent me. It's called The Trial of the Germans. If you haven't read it, it's quite interesting. It puts an interesting perspective on the whole thing.
Is it written by a German?
No. Davidson. You're welcome to borrow it if you wish, but...
It's very kind of you. Now, I've read the book by Ari Neve. It's a good book on Nuremberg.
Oh, yes. Yeah. He was... he interviewed some of the prisoners when he was there, didn't he?
I think so, yeah. And he had escaped from Colditz.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a whole other story. And then ultimately, ignominiously was blown up by a terrorist bomb. Jesus.
It's blown all the heck.
Yeah, isn't that incredible?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what happened to you after that?
We went back to base and then back to cell and then to England, to Topcliffe, and then proceeded to the act to where the hell did we debark from? I can't remember what port we left from. I really can't. And
so how did you find England post-war? Because by this time, Attlee was in the whole... They were still being rationed.
I didn't get a lot of time in Britain then. I had had two or three leaves from Germany in the between 45 and 46 and up to Denmark on a leave, but I went to my usual haunts and the people had relaxed, but I wasn't looking at consumer goods or GNP or anything like that. I still was immature enough to just enjoy the flesh pots of London and the museums and the cathedrals and all of that, and didn't really observe. No, a figure of speech. No, you know, the usual things.
Well,
drinking and wenching and dining and enjoying the countryside and.
Was London a disappointment for that? Because when I went there 2 years ago, I was disappointed with Soho. I expected more than I got.
Oh God! Well, my wife and I were there in '75, and we met a couple from North Van, and. My wife is quite a bit younger than I, and so were the other couple. They were about your age, and we went into a couple of pubs in Soho. So we had agreed to meet them there, and we went into a couple of pubs and sat down, and these gals, the hookers, were sitting next to us. And one came by and, are we on?
Oh, yeah.
Rubbed the great things over me, and she says, sorry, love. And then Lorraine looked at her. She said, I'll bet she's sorry. She's a very good lady. She doesn't yell at me. And we got out on the street, and they came after me and were soliciting me right in front of Lorraine. They break away tomorrow, love. Come and see me again, you know, this sort of thing. And bold as hell. And Tony, who is a hell of a good-looking guy, they didn't go near him. And so his wife and Lorraine were teasing Tony. And they said, what's with Chuck? And this kept on. You see, we went to two or three other places. And the same thing happened, so I guess they must have figured he's more prosperous because of his age and has more money. It couldn't have been anything else. But London, to me, has never been a disappointment. No. Other than meals, when we went back in 75, we found it almost impossible to get good food unless we paid some exorbitant price. And then we fell in with a colleague who took us around to some good restaurants that he knew of, and he was a Canadian living in London.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is for you a good meal?
Well, I like French cooking and something that you get at Napoleon in Vancouver and, you know, escargots and duck larange or something like that. You know, when you're on vacation, you want to eat well.
You do.
And this is what we looked for, and we had a hell of a time finding places open.
Mm-hmm.
And even to get a hamburger was a chore. We found an American bar and had a hamburger and a milkshake just for old time's sake.
Yeah.
But Britain...
But to be honest, I enjoyed having little pork pies at the...
Oh, we did that, a lot of that, yeah. We'd buy those in the pubs for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
But come dinner time, we wanted to dine.
Good meal, yeah.
Yeah, we'd buy pork pies in bake shops and go out into the Flodden Field or Culloden and have picnics and so on. It's fun. Yeah. Oh, no, we can slum with the best of them. Yeah.
Well, it's fun when you go to a foreign country, slum with the average person.
Right. In 75, we went over to the continent, and I went to Oldenburg again, and on the way by train, went through Rhina, the town I had bombed.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd been sleeping, and I opened my eyes, and I looked at the railway station, and it said, Rhina. And I said to Lorraine, my God, 30-odd years ago, we dropped bombs right on this very spot.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a funny feeling to do that. Then we went to Oldenburg, where I renewed acquaintance with this German couple, whose wife, she used to do my washing.
Mm-hmm.
And she had two little boys, and they were practically starving to death, so I felt sorry for the kids, and I didn't offer money for the laundry, I took food instead.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day she says, my husband's coming home tomorrow, he's been released from a prison camp, and he'd been in the Luftwaffe, like myself and ground crew, you know, not air crew. And I met him, and we became good friends, and on the Christmas Eve, they invited us, Percy Spencer, the Jew, and myself, to their home. And she had made a cake from God knows what and where, but they produced wine, and they had a little feast.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched the kiddies opening little presents, some of which we had taken. And it was probably one of the most moving experiences of my life. I didn't speak German very well.
Did they speak English very well?
They could speak little or no English, but I had a pretty... I could converse then. I can't now.
Mm.
And Percy spoke Yiddish, so it's close. And we carried on a good conversation, as, you know, at the level that we were then at. We didn't, you know, we weren't discussing German philosophers or anything like that.
No, it must have been awfully odd, a Jew, a German, and a Canadian.
But I was so deeply moved by all that.
The fact that these people could sit down and have a meal and be
that's
friendly
right.
together.
That's right. And here we were, you know, a month before Percy had been to Belsen, and... But he knew, and I knew, that Max had had screw-all to do with that. You know, he was just a flunky like ourselves, taking orders in some field. You know, he wasn't a high-command SS guard or anything like that. So, in 75, he gave me pictures of himself in the Luftwaffe, and we talked about our days in the service together, and,
mm-hmm.
and she gave me a little plate that she had made for Percy and I, but because we left Oldenburg rather suddenly, they never had a chance to present them. So she gave them to us all these years. We had corresponded, but she didn't want to entrust it to the mail. So on our way back, Lorraine and I stopped in Toronto and went into Shoppers Drug and gave Percy this plate.
You don't have
a little anecdote.
Yeah. You don't have it now, are
you? Yeah, it's over there.
Oh, I'd like to see the after.
Sure, I'll show you around.
Yeah. So happened? You got back to Canada?
I came back to Canada, went to Trenton, and occupied the rest of my days with demoting officers. At least that was my role, because there were all sorts of officers who were busted, if you want to use that term, from wing commander down to flight lieutenant. They wanted to stay in the service.
Oh, I guess you.
And they couldn't hold the ranks that they had attained.
Mm-hmm.
And some went down to two ranks, to warrant officers and sergeants and so on.
Mm-hmm.
That was their option, and others took their discharge, and then I left. And
was that a pleasant activity?
Oh, it didn't matter to me particularly, because I realized it had to be done, and one would be naive to think that the nation could maintain all this brass, you know, and effect a peaceful transition or a transition into peacetime activity.
Mm-hmm.
So I just took it as a matter of course. For the recipients of these demotions and transfers and all of that, I'm sure it affected them, as any action like that does.
Yeah.
You know, our ministry today laid off 67 people. So,
and that was a stinky... Well, I don't know how your feelings upon it, but Bennett has now said he's going to cut 15% of the
service. After we're taped here, I'll tell you some feelings on that if you want to talk about it. Yeah.
Okay. So you demobbed shortly after?
Yeah, in September of that year, I left the service, and...
That'd be 46?
46, and came to Hamilton, and took a job, and then began my business career.
Mm-hmm. And that was your dealings with the service, no militia?
Yes, for a short time in 19... Gee, I guess it's when I returned from... No, it was 51. I served for a little while with the medical wing in Hamilton because the doctor, our family doctor, was our medical officer in Germany, and he was in the reserves and asked me if I would help. So I did for a little while. And then I later was commissioned in the Argyll and Southern Highlanders in Hamilton. Okay. Well, in the Pay Corps. I was too old for an active commission, but they commissioned me into the Pay Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And I became a sub-lieutenant in the Argyll and Southern. And then shortly after, I was transferred out to British Columbia in 61.
Mm-hmm.
And I was commissioned in 60. 61, I was transferred to British Columbia and joined the British Columbia Regiment as assistant paymaster. And played around at that for a while, and then I thought it was all a bit silly, so I liked museum work, so I became curator. I left the active militia, and then I went on my own time and cleaned up their museum and put it together for them.
Mm-hmm. When did your interest in... You have a great many books, which I'll tell a tape recorder, and you've done a little bit of your own history work.
Mm-hmm.
When did that come about? Was that a general...
I've always enjoyed reading history, but it came about in North Vancouver when we were transferred out here.
Mm-hmm.
I had begun in Hamilton to collect firearms, military firearms, pistols and guns of the British Army and Navy. As I acquired these things, I thought, gee, they're rather impersonal. I wonder who they belong to and so on. And then I thought, well, I'll put a medal. I saw some medals in shops, and I noticed they were named. I thought, well, I've got a gun that was used at the Battle of Waterloo. I'll put a medal with it. And it was named to somebody in the Royal Artillery. And then I thought, well, gee. And then I began to find that you could research these people, and I started to buy more books.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought a book called British Battles and Medals, and that was the start. So then I became so intrigued with collecting medals, which were named and which were personal and identifiable mm-hmm. with individuals, that I sold all my firearms and bought medals instead, which often broke me and still does occasionally. I get overcommitted.
Well, looking at those Trafalgar medals, I bet they were mint.
And I just bought a whole set of medals for the Yangtze incident to all of the ships that were there, you know, and that sort of thing. But anyway, so this was the beginning of the building of the library, and after a while it becomes an insatiable thing. You just cannot get enough information on all these, and
mm-hmm.
I try to avoid paying the prices for new books, although I do buy good ones when they come by.
Mm-hmm.
But the used bookstores have been a good source, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've put together some pretty rare volumes,
And they're in very nice shape, too, I must say.
Well, quite a few are. Some are doggy.
Sometimes you have to take the doggy ones.
Sure.
Yeah.
Upgrade.
Yes.
I'll show you a few later that are kind of treasures.
I'd like to see them, yeah. I collect records, classical music.
Oh, do you? So do we.
Yeah.
Well, we have a few, yeah.
I'm passionate. I mean, I do it with passion.
Well,
I've got probably close to 1,000 records.
Oh, my God. Oh, well, we don't even begin to approach it. Yeah.
You should try moving them.
Moved them twice
in the past
yeah.
6 months.
Yeah.
Backbreaking.
Yeah.
I should probably turn the tape off because we're talking about my record collection.
That's
probably not what Dr.
Well, it's been enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.